My name is Randy Mork. Welcome to the Great War Podcast, soon to be known by another name, the First World War Podcast, subject to change, of course. You should check the website for maps and pictures that will help clarify some of this material. And again, I'm not a historian, so that being said, there might be information in here that is incorrect. I would urge anyone to exercise some fact-checking and respond to me on the website with any clarifications at www.thegreatwarpodcast.com, soon to be changed to www.thefirstworldwarpodcast.com. Anyway, let me make some corrections and clarifications before we get started. I called Germany and Austria in the first episode the Triple Entente. I have no idea how I managed that. I was thinking about how Italy might have gone in with the Germans and Austrians, and then I had three countries in mind when I wrote that part of the script. Anyway, that was incorrect. Germany, Austria, and later the Ottoman Empire would be known as the Central Powers. France, Great Britain, and Russia would be the Triple Entente, or the Allies. Also, this episode will be a little drier for some, as I have chosen to delve deeper into the battles and strategies at the beginning of the war. I felt it was necessary to tell the story properly. It's imperative to understand how you wind up with two groups of men in trenches trying to kill each other for the next 4 years. I will also be shortening the episodes past this down to about 20 minutes as things will settle down a bit. I hope you enjoy the story. The civilian populations of the industrialized nations were ecstatic to go to war in 1914. It was a chance to show how superior your country was. The motto in Great Britain was Home for Christmas. Great Britain's standing peacetime army only had just under 250,000 men. In August of 1914 alone, Great Britain's enlistments total was 300,000 men. In September, it would increase to 450,000 men. Russian civilians stormed and plundered the German embassy while celebrating the declaration of war. In one of the books I'm using, there is a picture of a crowd in Munich at a pro-war demonstration. In it, there is a young man from Austria that is usually blown up. Although the photo is somewhat grainy, Adolf stands there, mouth agape, looking like the declaration of war is the greatest thing since sauerkraut. Some say the photo is a fake from the Nazi years. I think the effect is still just as chilling nonetheless. If you Google Hitler in Munich in 1914, you're sure to find the picture. Last time, we ended off with Erich Ludendorff and the German army blasting their way down through the fortresses of Liège and Namur. Although the fortresses of Namur would not fall till the 23rd of August, the Kaiser's troops have started moving past them into France. The French are attacking the Germans in the hilly country of Alsace-Lorraine. British soldiers have been landing in France since the 7th. The Austrians and Serbians are launching their own invasions, and in East Prussia, two huge Russian armies have crossed the border. On the Eastern Front, a more ominous threat is building, though. In previous meetings, the French had asked the Russians to attack Germany by the 15th day of mobilization. The Russians, although economically backwards during this time period, have managed to put together two massive armies. In command of the German forces on the Eastern Front is Maximilian von Prittwitz. The Russians, led by Alexander Samsonov, now outnumber the Germans by 29-16. During the first few weeks of the war, the Germans in Prussia had won a small-scale battle against the Russians. For some reason, von Prittwitz ordered a withdrawal towards the town of Gambino. The Germans counterattacked on the 20th, but the commander did not wait for reinforcements. The Russians were able to break the attack up with artillery fire, and the Germans retreated to the fortresses south of Königsberg. Von Prittwitz, after intercepting Russian plans to encircle him, now ordered a retreat to the other side of the Vistula River. He left only a skeleton force of cavalry to man the fortresses. Von Prittwitz had effectively given the Russians East Prussia. The situation in the east was starting to look bad for the Germans. So this is where we start to catch up with where we were last time. Remember our old buddy Eric Ludendorff, the one who was stomping his way through the Belgian defenses at Liège? The Germans knew they were in trouble, so the German chief of staff, Helmuth von Moltke, decided to put together a team of the Germans' best generals to deal with the Russians. He dragged a man named Paul von Hindenburg out of retirement and teamed him up with Ludendorff. They were up against two Russian commanders named Samsonov and Rennenkampf. Von Moltke called Ludendorff from the Western Front on the 20th. Paul von Hindenburg was 66 years old in 1914. He had fought in the Franco-Prussian War as a lieutenant and retired in 1911. Upon reapplying for service at the beginning of the war, he was taken up on his offer by von Moltke. Hindenburg was known for his authority and steadying hand, which made an excellent team with Ludendorff's intellect and ruthlessness. Von Moltke also sent three cavalry corps from the Western Front to help bolster the Eastern defenses. This is despite Ludendorff's complaint that they would not arrive in time to effect the initial battle and would only serve to weaken the forces facing the Belgians on the Western Front. Hindenburg and Ludendorff arrived on the 23rd of August. They immediately endorsed a plan put into effect by the outgoing von Prittwitz. You see, Rennenkampf and Samsonov are transmitting their plans by radio in the clear. This was because most Russian battalions could not decode messages from other units. They just didn't have the code books. This, along with a poor supply line, bad troop morale, and inadequately supplied troops, would contribute to the disaster that was going to unfold. The Russians were broadcasting their plans to besiege the Germans at Königsberg, not realizing that the defenders there were a thin German cavalry screen. An officer on von Prittwitz's staff, named Max Hoffmann, had studied with the Russians. He knew that Samsonov and Rennenkampf hated each other and figured the two men would stay away instead of work with each other. Also, the Russians under Rennenkampf were taking the bait around the fortifications at Königsberg and were advancing very cautiously, thinking that the German main force still manned the defenses. Hoffmann is the real brains behind the battle that would be known as Tannenberg. On the 22nd, the Russians under Samsonov attacked. The German 20th Corps retreated in order to avoid being encircled. Samsonov, believing his flanks were secured, and advanced after the Germans. That night, Hoffmann, after leaving a meeting, learned of a Russian radio transmission from Rennenkampf. In it, he states that he will continue to reduce the fortifications around Königsberg. They also intercepted a message from Samsonov stating his intention to just keep pressing forward. So now they know Rennenkampf is not near enough to provide Samsonov aid. So, brilliant, Team Russia, just brilliant. Despite some of the German leadership being skeptical, Hoffmann convinced them the radio transmission was true. Now, this Russian army was operating in a country that did not use the same railway gauge lines as they did. Therefore, they did not have the supply lines that were adequate to their needs. They also would have a lot of problems resupplying their troops once the ammunition started running low. Ludendorff had a few corps hold the line. The rest of the army went to flank the Russian First Army under Samsonov, moving troops on the railway lines. On the 27th, the German trap was being sprung. This is a quote from a German soldier in the attack. It's from Hugh Strachan's book, The First World War. Quote, "As we at the head of the column came out of the dreadful wood, a shower of infantry fire suddenly hailed down on us. Lieutenant Colonel Schultz stopped a bullet in the temple and fell like a board. But he soon came to, swore frightfully, and asked for a cigarette. Meanwhile, we had brought up artillery from the wood, and the Russian rabble, leaving behind a number of rifles and packs, beat a retreat back into the darkness from which they had emerged." End quote. By the 29th, the Germans had the Russian First Army surrounded. The German cavalry screen at the fortifications around Königsberg succeeded in keeping Rennenkampf from coming to Samsonov's aid in time. By the battle's end on the 30th, the closest unit from Rennenkampf's army was still 40 miles away. His army stretched all the way back to Königsberg. The Russian First Army suffered 90,000 captured men, 80,000 killed or wounded, and had just 10,000 soldiers escape. Compare this to the 12,000 men total the Germans lost. Rather than tell the Russian Tsar Nicholas personally, Samsonov walked alone into a nearby grove of trees and shot himself. Max Hoffmann came up with the idea of calling the battle Tannenberg after a reversal that the Germans had suffered by the Poles and Lithuanians in the Middle Ages. Now that Team Hindenburg had wiped out one Russian army, they turned their attention to the only remaining Russian army in German territory, Rennenkampf. Once Rennenkampf realized he wouldn't make it to Samsonov in time, he ordered a retreat as his forces were very spread out. He formed a new line running from Königsberg to the Masurian Lakes, put his most experienced troops in the front lines. The idea was to ford up till another Russian army arrived on scene from the south. Hindenburg moved north to attack the Russian First Army. By now, the reinforcements from the Western Front had arrived, and Hindenburg was able to attack the Russian southern flank. The Russians counterattacked in the center, and the Germans fell back there while still attacking in the south. Eventually, the Russians' units in the south started to collapse. Rennenkampf realized he was being encircled and ordered a retreat. His rear guard fought the Germans tenaciously and bought his army's survival. By the 13th of September, the Russian First Army had retreated back to their frontier fortifications. Nevertheless, the army was severely mauled. The Russian 10th Army that was advancing from the south to assist was now outclassed and forced to retreat to its jumping-off point. These two losses would hamper the Russian ability to commit to an offensive. They would not be able to commit to one until 1915. The French, meanwhile, were moving up towards the Germans invading through Belgium in the north and actively attacking them in Alsace and Lorraine in the south. Let's take a bit and talk about the French soldier in 1914. We talked about this last time, but it's important. We'll once again go over how the French attributed their defeat in the Franco-Prussian War to using static defenses. Now, they had developed a new tactic called élan. It means that fortune stays with the attacker. When the French attacked, it was in formation like something you had seen in armies 50 or 60 years before this. Then the machine guns and artillery would open up with predictable results on the French. The overall French commander was a man named Joseph Joffre. He was a big proponent of élan. Joffre was in the army during the Franco-Prussian War and had survived several purges of defensive-minded officers by his adherence to élan. Other officers were critical of him and thought that he was a better logistician than a strategist. After a new government was elected in 1914, he was scheduled to be replaced, but the war postponed that. This French army, at least as far as dress is concerned, could sign up with Napoleon 100 years earlier. They went to war in 1914 wearing bright red pants and a blue jacket. Their cavalrymen wore plumed, shiny helmets, and some still wore the chest armor that was designed to stop a slashing sword. Now, the French really wanted to take Alsace-Lorraine back, as they had lost that area during the Franco-Prussian War. They start attacking the Germans on the 8th of August. Despite some early setbacks, the French gain momentum and start pushing them out. Only the German commander, Prince Ruprecht, is toying with them. The Germans retreat to lines where they have prepared artillery and machine gun emplacements. The soldiers not needed for the defense start to flank the French. In 1914, Paul Taffreau was a 27-year-old Frenchman from Bordeaux. He is a teacher and just completed his military service. Being highly patriotic, he is swept up as an officer in the first wave of French mobilization. He finds himself attacking in one of these battles in Alsace-Lorraine. When he talks of supplies, I am assuming he means ammunition for the artillery. This is from the book Intimate Voices by Svetlana Palmer. Quote, A beautiful day. We march all morning, and around noon we reach a deep gully below a little village now very familiar to us, Barcy. German shells rain down methodically and relentlessly, screaming, awesome explosions, dense black and reddish smoke. I'm ordered to support the sail company. I push forward, desperate to catch up with them, but they are advancing too quickly. We'll make up the ground. Bullets start whizzing by from unseen guns. I stop several times to regroup my men. I manage to collect just one artillery unit. We pass a colonel who points me to the left of a row of poplars. Following a gully, I squeeze my company in between two others in a beetroot field. They advance rapidly, and before the angle they form disappears, I try to protect them by firing blind. Their march forward is magnificent, but too fast, too close together. One rank kneels, one rank stands up. We advance with them, but my artillery men are way behind. Finally, here comes Shamootin, all upset. Poor Mare, a bullet in his heart, he only just got here. I realize the supplies won't reach us because we are going too fast, and certain people who talk a good war are overcautious, such as Fat L, who will use this as an excuse not to send them. In any case, we must push forward and, if possible, support the bayonet charge, which is imminent. End quote. Gaps started appearing in the French lines, and they were forced to retreat before being enveloped. By the 22nd of August, the French were back behind their fortifications at the jumping-off point. Crown Prince Ruprecht then convinced von Moltke to send him reinforcements, as he believed the beaten French could be surprised and overwhelmed easily. Von Moltke agreed, taking yet more troops from the north in Belgium and sending them south. French reconnaissance airplanes spotted the German attack, and they were repulsed. By the 7th of August, the British Army, called the British Expeditionary Force, or BEF for short, started landing in France. Their commanding general was a man called Sir John French, and he hated the French. Sir John was known as a hard-charging and an emotional cavalry officer. The BEF was very small and hadn't had to fight in a war in continental Europe since the Crimean War in the 1840s. They were to support the Belgians by keeping their army on their left or north, and the French army to their south. This meant they needed to get to a place called Mons in Belgium to link up with their allies. So, let's take a step back. It's the 16th of August, 1914. The Russians have invaded East Prussia with two huge armies. On this day, Ludendorff, fresh from his victory at Liege, will be called to the east to team up with Hindenburg. They have started attacking the Belgian fortresses at Namur. The Germans are letting the French push them back in Alsace-Lorraine before they spring their surprise there. The Austrians are making slow progress invading Serbia, and the Serbians have invaded the Austrian province of Bosnia. Back to the main story. The BEF arrives at Mons on the 22nd of August and quickly establishes their positions. They know the only thing between them and the full German army is the Belgian fortresses at Namur. But at least they have their allies, the Belgians to the north and the French to the south. The man commanding the French army on the British right is named Charles Le Ranzac. He commands the French 5th Army. On the 21st, while the British were still taking up positions, Le Ranzac was ordered by Joffre to attack the Germans. Despite his misgivings, he started preparing an attack. The Germans beat him to the punch, however, on the 21st. Le Ranzac counterattacked, but the 9 French divisions were defeated by just 3 German divisions. By the 23rd of August, they had opened up holes in the French line. Le Ranzac started retreating, leaving the British flank open. Sir John French agreed to hold the Germans for a day to allow Le Ranzac to withdraw. And now for a sideline. The first British soldier to kill someone in World War I was on the 22nd of August when a cavalry officer of the British fought a German cavalryman. The British were out scouting when the fighting began. The combat was all on horseback. The German used a lance while the British soldier used a sword. things would change a lot over the next few years. The BEF was left with an open flank on the 23rd when the final fortresses at Namur fell and the German armies under Karl von Bülow came flooding through. They have the Mons Canal in front of them and they are entrenched, though. Unfortunately, the French that are right are retreating. Most of the soldiers of the BEF were old hands at the different small-scale wars in the British Empire had been in, though. The Boer War left many of them with respect for the range of the bolt-action rifle and the protection entrenchments would provide. In the BEF, at the time, you were considered an average shot if you could hit 15 targets in a minute at 1,000 yards. They would walk out in a row, and the British professional soldiers would shoot them so quickly that it is documented most of the Germans thought they were using machine guns exclusively. One British soldier would later describe it as like mowing them down like grass. That being said, the German army facing them still outnumbered them 3-1 in men and artillery. They brought their artillery and started to pound the BEF. The casualty list started to mount. This next quote gets a bit gory, but I feel it's needed. It's taken from the mammoth book of Eyewitness World War I by John E. Lewis. It's Corporal Bernard Denmore of the 1st Royal Berkshire Regiment on the 23rd of August 1914. Quote, "The artillery fire from the Germans was very, very heavy, but was dropping behind us on a British battery. The company officer who had stayed out in the open the whole time had taken a couple of men to get the wounded away from the battery behind us. He returned about 6:30 p.m. when the firing had died down a bit and told us the battery had been blown to bits. I was then sent with four men on outpost to a signal box at a level crossing and found it was being used as a clearing station for wounded. After dark, more wounded men were brought in from the 9th Battery RFA. One man was in a very bad way and kept shrieking for somebody to bring a razor and cut his throat, and two others died almost immediately. I was going to move a bundle of hay when somebody called out, 'Look out, chum, there's a bloke in there.' I saw a leg completely severed from its body and suddenly felt very sick and tired. The German rifle fire started again, and the artillery man I was talking to was shot dead. I was sick then. Nothing much happened during the night except for one man spent the time kissing a string of rosary beads, and another swore practically the whole night." End quote. All day the Germans attacked, trying to take bridges over the canal. One BEF machine gun section covering the Nimy Bridge had lost all but two of its men by the end of the day. A man named Lieutenant Dees operated the machine gun despite being shot four times. Once he was wounded a fifth time, he was taken to an aid station where he died later in the day. A Private Sidney Godley took over the gun and covered the retreat of pretty much the whole BEF. After his comrades were safely away, he disabled the machine gun by throwing critical parts into the canal and then surrendered to the Germans. The BEF retreated and fought a rearguard action for the rest of the night. During the Battle of Mons, the British lost about 1,600 men and the Germans about 5,000. They had succeeded in keeping the Germans from enveloping the French under the Ransaxo. The Germans won the battle, but most that had been there realized that it was a very pyrrhic victory. The BEF now starts to retreat steadily, trying to keep in formation with the French on their right. Communication between the Allies is poor. The line is bending at Verdun, and the Germans are pushing the northern end towards Paris. The French and British tried to check the German advance at a place called St. Quentin on the 29th and 30th, but are beaten again. They have been retreating since the 23rd, and some will still be walking till the 10th of September. During the Great Retreat, as it was called, most of these soldiers would just sleep for a few hours every 3 or 4 days. Then they would just walk for a while before having to turn around and beat off another German attack. This is another quote from our old friend, Captain Bernard Denmore of the 1st Royal Berkshire Regiment during the Great Retreat, August 28, 1914, from the Mammoth Book of Eyewitness World War I by John E. Lewis. Quote, "Again, at dawn, we started on the march. and during the first halt, another fellow shot himself through the foot. The roads were in a terrible state. The heat was terrific. There seemed to be very little order about anything, and mixed up with us and wandering all over the road were refugees, with all sorts of conveyances, prams, trucks, wheelbarrows, and tiny little carts drawn by dogs. They were piled up with what looked like beds and bedding, and all of them asked us for food, which we could not give them, as we had none ourselves. The men were discarding their equipment in a wholesale fashion, in spite of orders to the contrary. Also, many of them fell out and rejoined towards dusk. They had been riding on limbers and wagons and officers' chargers, and generally looked worse than those of us who kept going all day. That night I went on outpost, but I did not know where exactly, as things were getting hazy in my mind. I tried to keep a diary, although it was against orders. Anyway, I couldn't realize that all that was happening, and only knew that I was always tired, hungry, unshaven, and dirty. My feet were sore, water was scarce. In fact, it was issued in half pints, and we were not allowed to touch the native water. The regulations were kept in force in that respect, so much so that two men were put under arrest and sentenced to field punishment for stealing bread from an empty house. Then again, it wasn't straight marching, for every few hours we had to deploy and beat off an attack, and every time somebody I knew was killed or wounded. After we had beaten off the attacking force, on we went again, retiring. End quote. This is about where von Moltke's decisions to draw units from his armies that were on the heels of the BEF and the French starts to show. Von Kluck, the man commanding the army that is pursuing them, makes the decision to travel to the east of Paris. The original Schlieffen plan we talked about last month called for the outermost German army to cross to the west of Paris. Schlieffen himself said that the last man on the right would brush the channel with his shoulder. Von Moltke had drawn off reinforcements from the battles in Alsace and to send off to Hindenburg in the east. Von Kluck no longer has the strength to envelop Paris. Now the German army loses contact with the BEF north of Paris. Von Kluck knows that the French army under Loransac, the same one that's been on the British flank since Mons, is somewhere to the east of Paris. He figures if he can catch the French, they will be easy game, and he'll also find the British. Meanwhile, Joffre is desperately drawing troops from the increasingly stable Alsace-Lorraine area and forming a new army in Paris. It is the 6th under the command of Michael Joseph Mannery. Now, with the addition of the new French army and the removal of the troops for Alsace and East Prussia, the Germans are outnumbered. The Battle of the Marne, as it is called, is about to start. Sir John French, by this time, is appalled by the losses his BEF has taken. During the retreat, contact with the French on his right under Loransac was spotty at best. He has no confidence in his French allies. He declines to attack the Germans several times. Joffre eventually personally visits him. French, with tears in his eyes over the men he has lost, eventually agrees to the attack. The battle starts on the 5th of September, 1914. The Germans start out winning and pushing the French back, at one point creating gaps in the French 9th Army that prompted Foch to say, "My center is giving away, my right is in retreat, situation is excellent, I attack." Meanwhile, the French are using a new invention to outmaneuver the Germans. They are rushing the 6th Army from Paris to the battlefield using taxis and private automobiles. The Germans are taken aback at how quick the French army materializes. The Germans keep hammering at them till the 12th, when the bigger picture became clear to the high command. They now realize they are outnumbered and trapped. Germany starts a retreat. The battered BEF and the French stumble along behind them. The situation is now reversed. The Allied pursuit is too slow, and they eventually stumble into the Germans behind brand spanking new trenches at the Aisne River. The opposing armies start to try to outflank each other in the north in what is called the Race to the Sea, which will last until mid-October. Von Moltke's health declined shortly thereafter and was replaced by Erich von Falkenhayn on the 25th of October, 1914. Just prior to the war breaking out, the Germans were apparently told by Sir Edward Grey that they could keep the French out of the war. The Kaiser was ecstatic and told von Moltke to send the troops in the west out east to fight the Russians. Von Moltke rejected the plan, saying that the Schlieffen plan could not be changed, especially as some of the troops were already embarked. Which makes me wonder, if he was such an adherent to the Schlieffen plan, why did he keep peeling off reinforcements at the drop of a hat? Let's take a minute here and work around some of the other things that are changing the way this conflict is being fought. During the retreat from Mons and the fighting in Alsace-Lorraine, a new way to fight is being invented. One that would change things as much as when the first man tamed a horse. And then immediately thought about how much treasure and women he could plunder with that aforementioned horse. This is a quote from an officer in the Royal Flying Corps named Lieutenant W.R. Reed. It's taken from August of 1914. At the beginning of the war, the Flying Corps had 63 planes. None of them were armed. Taken from the Mammoth Book of Eyewitness World War I by John E. Lewis. Quote, "One day after our reconnaissance over Mons and Charleroi, Jackson," Reed's observer, "spotted a German Taube machine. I had also seen him, but we had done our job and I did not want to fight. Jackson was always bloodthirsty, however. The following shouted conversation ensued. Jackson, look, old boy. Me, yes, I know. Jackson, I think we ought to go for him, old boy. Me, better get home with your report. Jackson, I think we ought to go for him, old boy. Me, all right. I changed course for him, and as we passed the Taube, Jackson got in two shots with the rifle. We turned and passed each other again with no obvious result. This happened three or four times. Then, have you got your revolver, old boy? My ammunition is all gone. I, feeling rather sick of the proceedings, say, yes, but no ammo. Give it to me, old boy, and this time fly as close to him as you can. I carried out instructions, and, to my amazement, as soon as we got opposite the Taube, Jackson, with my Army-issue revolver grasped by the barrel, threw it at the Taube's propeller. Of course it missed, and then, honor satisfied, we turned for home." End quote. Orville and Wilbur had only invented their crazy machine 11 years before this, and the technology was still very primitive. The planes were made of fabric and light wood and glue holding it all together. There are other stories from this time frame of pilots flying over their enemy and trying to bring the landing gear down on their plane, forcing the other plane to crash land. The French take advantage of some primitive strategic bombing during their campaign in Alsace-Lorraine and bomb a German Zeppelin base. When I say bomb, don't think of anything like it was in World War II. This usually amounted to some guy chucking primitive hand grenades or even darts directly out of the cockpit. Obviously, they thought the idea had its merits, though. On September the 22nd, 1914, the armored cruisers Aboukir, Crécy, and Hogue were patrolling the North Sea. They were to attack German shipping. At first, the Aboukir exploded and capsized after about 5 minutes. The Crécy and Hogue, figuring the Aboukir had struck an underwater mine, rushed in to assist. The Hogue exploded next. During the confusion, the Crécy tried to ram what she thought was a submarine, but after failing, she turned around to assist the drowning sailors. Two torpedoes would explode against her. She capsized within sight of Dutch trawlers. They would not assist her for fear of entering what they thought was a minefield. The submarine was the German U-9. Let's look at this for a second. The Germans, for the price of one submarine, have just taken out three older but still versatile ships of the Royal Navy. Remember, the British have made their navy their focus, as they are an island nation that rules an overseas empire. In fact, Their naval building policy is to maintain a navy large enough to take on any two major powers they might go to war with. Now, for the price of zero losses, some diesel fuel, the cost of the sub and six torpedoes, the Germans have destroyed three cruisers, inflicted 1,500 losses, and this is probably the most important. They have influenced several other countries that had been wondering which side to go with. Which, I think, provides a nice segue into the next section. The Germans had been trying to outclass the British Navy for a decade. This naturally sent them into a building war to see who could build the most ships. During this time period, if your country was powerful, you had to have a few dreadnoughts. They were incredibly expensive ships and would be outclassed by the next generation that would come a few years later, but the prestige they bought was worth it. Great Britain, as the world's foremost navy, had been building two for the Ottoman Empire when the war broke out. They were the Rashida and the Sultan Osman I. At the start of the war, the British seized the ships. A tide of anti-British sentiment swept through the Turkish population. In response, the Germans sailed a couple of cruisers, the Goeben and the Breslau, up the Dardanelles and gave them to the Turkish on the 10th of August. The Germans were making the best out of a bad situation, though, as the ships were outclassed by the British fleet that had blockaded them inside the Mediterranean, and then chased them to the Turks. The Ottomans would use those same ships when they entered the war on the 29th of October to shell cities. They would join the Central Powers. Moving on to the Austrian side of things. Franz Xaver Joseph Conrad Graf von Hotzendorf was the general in charge of the Austrian armies. From now on, he will be called Conrad. I will not read that whole name again. He had little to no actual combat experience, but wrote prolifically on tactics. He was a vocal proponent of modernizing the military as well as a spoiling attack against Serbia. However, at the beginning of the war, he actually argued against an attack on Serbia as he knew the Austrian forces were not fully mobilized yet. Austria had decided to attack Russia as well as Serbia. Unfortunately for them, the Russians had also decided to attack Austria. The Austrians were pulled between their desire to stomp a mud hole in Serbia and their desire to help the Germans in East Prussia by launching an offensive of their own into Russia. They never did get squared away who they were going to attack first, though, and the Russians were able to mobilize enough soldiers for an invasion of Austria. A series of confusing battles erupted between them around two fortress cities, Limburg and Przemysl, and Limburg, I think I pronounced right. Przemysl, on the other hand, well, eventually, jealous of his allies' victories in East Prussia, Conrad withdrew his forces to behind Limburg. He was trying to lure the Russians into chasing him. They did, and Conrad tried to outflank them with a far weaker force. The Russians, in return, had almost encircled him by the 6th of September. Conrad would escape, but the Russians kept coming. The Austrians had already mobilized all the soldiers they could, while the Russians had almost an infinite supply. Conrad abandoned the fortresses at Przemysl and the 150,000 men that garrisoned those forts. They withdrew to the Carpathian Mountains 150 miles away. During the course of these battles, the Austrians would find that many of their soldiers of Slavic ethnicity would not fight or would surrender at the first opportunity to the Russians. The vast majority of their soldiers couldn't speak the language of their officers, which was German or Hungarian. They held no common ties to those that were leading them. This also marks one of those moments that will become commonplace during the rest of the war. During this battle, the Austrians would appeal to the German cousins for help. This time, the Germans refused it, and it nearly lost the war for the Austrians. The Kaiser noticed. Radomir Putnik was the commander of all of the Serbian army. His family had fled the Ottomans in the 1680s to the Austrian Empire. Radomir's father moved the family to Serbia after the Ottoman Empire had lost its influence in the area. He was known as a great leader that reformed the military by getting rid of useless and incompetent officers. The Serbians started out the war with an army that was severely short of supplies, though. The two Balkan wars had sapped their ammunition stocks. They did not have enough rifles to equip even their frontline units. More rifles were ordered from Russia, but they didn't arrive till the second half of August. Only the frontline Serbian soldier got pants and a shirt for a uniform. Boots were not supplied. All other soldiers just wore what they had on their backs. At the beginning of the war, the Serbians called up all able-bodied men between the ages of 21 and 45 years. This brought their strength up to 450,000 men. Out of that, only 250,000 were frontline troops. The rest were for transportation, cooks, medics, etc. Lest we forget, Montenegro, Serbia's ally, also mustered 35,000 men and brought 65 artillery pieces, some of them from as early as the 1870s. They were faced with three Austrian armies totaling 500,000 men, led by a man named Oskar Potoric. He had ridden in the car with Princess Sophie and Franz Ferdinand and had a score to settle. The original plan was to have the armies invade from the north and the west of the country on the 12th and to trap the Serbian military. Potoric wanted to hand Serbia to Franz Joseph on his birthday, the 18th of August. He attacked from the west only into hilly country that favored the defense, with just over half his forces available. Putnik at first thought that the attack was a feint, but soon came to the realization that the Austrians were in fact being just that silly. The Serbs counterattacked and beat off the Austrians easily. Before long, they had pushed the Austrians out of Serbian territory altogether. The Serbs counterattacked at the request of their allies. If they could upset the Austrians enough, it would ensure that the troops would not make it to fight the battles in Russia. The Serb First Army led an invasion of Austria across the Drina River. Austria, figuring the best way to stop the Serb invasion, was one of their own invasions, launched an attack across the Drina River on the 7th of September. Unfortunately, they attacked from the west into the exact same hilly country they had tried to invade 3 weeks before. This time the Austrians still took a pounding, but were able to dig entrenchments and hold their ground. The area would settle down a bit till the next offensive in November, and the Austrians were pretty darn busy with the Russians right now anyway. Next month, we'll see the first signs of the traditional trench warfare on the Western Front, as well as the old man of Europe entering the fray. We'll also see some of the horrible things a soldier had to endure just to survive in this new industrialized warfare. Thanks for listening. Hopefully we'll see you next month. I'm Randy Mork.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way.